I guess perhaps that the melting point has slowly moved up the graph. You know, I feel like maybe the indignation point of most of us has dropped almost to a negligible level. It doesn't even exist anymore. Well, of course, this is a thing that you have to take in your stride. You just can't walk into life, you know, unprepared. You must know whither thou goest. And thou askest thyself this in the past 24 hours. Whither goest thou? Whence and why? It's dark. And the images are clear. I mean, it's always there. The clams are always out there, millions of them nibbling away. I can just see this guy now walking up the side of the... Well, you don't walk, you see, when you're a slave. He's toiling up the side of the pyramids. The sun is growing low down there. It's surprising. The sun goes down in the west, even in Egypt. And he's ancient Egypt. And he's working his way up there, you know. And he's toiling, and he's number 42 man on a rope that's pulling up a 10,000-pound slab of granite. He's working his way up there, and he's sweating. And you can see his old shoulder blades sticking out there like a couple of spades, just hanging out there. And his jawbone is working as he's trying to chew the straw that keeps him from completely going under. Thousands of them are doing it now, toiling upward, 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 building this gigantic edifice to ego. It's the only thing that's kind of toiling up. And all he can think about is that he can hardly wait for get through with work today so he can get back to the hut. We can pick up the argument with his chick. The argument that's been going on forever. And he's pulling and tugging. Pulling and tugging. Just like 18 billion of us today. Pulling and tugging, struggling, fighting, fist fighting, sweating. And the eternal argument goes on. Now, of course, some people have learned to deal with it, as we say in the acting profession. You deal with your problem. To use it. You know, what is it, the phrase, use your problem? You hear this all the time in acting classes. You have a problem, you're nervous, use it. Use the tension that develops out of that nervousness as part of the scene. Use it as a device, and it'll springboard you into greater action, into more complete understanding of the way things are. You still there? Are you with me, old toilers up the vast side of the eternal pyramid, tugging at the eternal rope of serfdom, slavedom, of being just alive, you know? How's the argument going? Who's ahead? I mean, the argument, you know. The argument. It happens very early in life. Like this one time, I'm a kid, you see. And my mother discovered someplace downtown where you could get cheap haircuts. And, you know, haircuts for kids, haircuts, you know. And they cost money. And she sent me down to this place. I will tell you, I guess this must be prefaced with a little tiny note that says, revelation occurs at unexpected moments, but remains forever, burning like a little candle flame there, back of the screen. The beaded screen of perception. Is the astigmatic effect beginning to take definite toll on your vision? That is your vision of the world. Can you see that? You know what is it, the halo effect? You ever seen this? How are you on the halogen series? Anybody tonight? I'm going to, by the way, I think what we're going to have to start doing because of the way things are going, I think we ought to have, as a listener, do you think this is a good idea? We'll put this out before the class here tonight. We like, you know, a little democracy here once in a while. Speaking of that, who was it? There was somebody said, I was just reading the quotation tonight. Some ancient said, one thing you can tell about minorities is that they're almost always right. Of course, this is another one of the problems, you know, with throwing out to the mass, but I would like to say this. Do you think it would be a good idea if we had a test every 6 weeks to weed out the dead wood in the audience? I could send out little blue books, give you 12 essay questions. Mr. Bruner did or did not work at the roundhouse. True or false? And in less than 25 words, would you please describe Mr. Bruno? Do you think this would work? Do you think it would matter, one way or the other? Well, I'll tell you about the haircut, you see. Revelation. It comes, like I say, the lightning bolt strikes. You never know what's going to happen. Like one time, I'm sitting in a drugstore. I'm about 9 years old. And this drugstore had big windows way up at the top, like ventilation windows. And it's summertime, beautiful day. And I'm sitting there in the booth, and I'm spending my entire weekly income, you know. I'm squirting it out. You never know what's going to happen. I'm sitting there with two kids. One guy's named Jimmy Cannon. And Jimmy Cannon's father, by the way, owned a drugstore down the street. And he used to needle his old man by going to the opposite drugstore and ordering lemon cokes. And then coming home and say, well, I had a great lemon coke down at Thompson's. Well, all the way through our lives, we're doing this. All the way through, we can't stop in our own way. And we're sitting there downing this thing. I've got a vanilla malt is what I was doing. And I remember this. I was in a vanilla malt phase. And I'm knocking down the vanilla malt. And suddenly, something made me look up. One of the windows has fallen out, complete with frame. It is falling right on us. It just lands right there in front of me. Bang, knocks over my vanilla malt. Bounces up, cracks me on the jaw. Knocks me cockeyed for about 30 seconds. I reel around a little bit. And the next thing you know, Mr. Thompson is over there, and he has put on the table in front of me five vanilla malts. Just keep your mouth shut, kid. He was afraid of getting sued. You're the first one I've told about this. I downed five vanilla malts as the bribe and went home with a big lump on the back of my neck. And I never said where I got it. I got my price. It's easily met, too. Like every other man. You know, while on the subject of price, you see, my mother sent me down to this haircuttery. And I had been going to Chuck, the haircut man, and it was also Elmer, the haircut man. There were several haircut men. There was Ernie, the haircut man. There were three various... Oh, I did an awful thing once in the haircut place. But that's another thing. I went to this new one, which was downtown, and I walked in, and a kid, you know, going to get a haircut is in a very bad way to begin with, because you can't tell him, you know, even at this stage. Now, I can't tell a guy who's operating the shears how to cut my hair. Can you, Ed, really? They always say, well, how would you like it? And you say, oh, well, use your own judgment or something. Women don't have this problem. No, it's the truth. It's a very embarrassing situation. So I went down, and I'm sitting there as a kid, you know, and there was this German haircutter. He was a barber, very official kind, you know, with the collars that are sort of sunken into his neck, big rolls of stuff hanging out down there, and little thin hair. And he's, well, how are you, little boy? And he's cutting around there and all that, and it takes him about 30 seconds to do my hair, which was much better than Chuck. Chuck would stop and pick his teeth and listen to the radio and look out of the window and all that stuff, and I like this. Well, I got home. I arrived home, and there was a moment, terrible moment of silence. My mother looked at me and says, you go right back there and tell them they gave you a rotten haircut and tell them to start over again and do it right. Oh, boy. What an embarrassing thing. Of course, you see what, you know, how if you can imagine a bad haircut on a kid. It's a funny thing. It looked like a little fungus on the top of a bowling ball I had gotten, and somehow she wanted him to fix it. So I went back to the haircuttery. And all the way back, it's like I'm approaching doom or something, to have to go in and tell the barber, you did a terrible job. My mother says it was an awful haircut, and you got to fix it. And I'm working my way back, and I get in front of this haircut place, and they had this big haircut thing out there. You know, the barber pole that's spinning around, and it's spinning, and I'm looking around the barber pole, and there was this big thing on the front there, you know, and the barber, Lucky Tiger hair tonic, and all the guys were sitting. There must have been 48 guys in there by this time. All the guys from the mill have arrived, and they're all sitting around picking their teeth and listening to the radio and talking, and I'm waiting outside for my moment. And I knew I couldn't do it, and I knew I had to do it. I could not go back home and say, he fixed it. And there it is, you know, the same old ears sticking out, and the knobs and all that, and the tufts everywhere. You can't fake that. And I sweated it out for about, it must have been about 2 hours, and it was Saturday, and the haircut place stayed open till 9 that night. And I stood past supper time until finally there was hardly anybody in there. And I went sneaking in, and he says, what do you want, kid? Did you get your change? And he says, Hotto, did you give him his change? There's always a head haircut man, you know. And the head haircut man is the one who handles the money. He's usually in the chair next to the window. Otto was the guy in the last chair who had given me my haircut. and I did not know what I was about to perpetrate. I walked in. He says, "What's the matter, kid?" This was the head one. He says, did you lose your change? Did you forget something in the shop?" He had recognized me. I said, "No." "So what's the matter?" And Otto is sitting in his chair all the way in the back. Big old fat Otto with a mustache and that thin hair, the big rolls of fat hanging down over his collar. And Otto looks at me, and I think Otto must have known. He just looked. And I said, "My mother said that you're going to have to do my haircut over." And the head haircut man looked back at Otto, and Otto looked at me. Says, "What is the matter with your haircut?" "My mother said it isn't a good haircut. You're going to have to do it over again." "Okay, kid, come on back here." And I sat in the chair, and the man up in the front didn't say anything. He's up there counting the cash, and Otto is working over on me. He is very carefully clipping. He is working. It takes him about a half an hour, and I'm sweating. Very embarrassing. Nobody says anything, and I'm just a kid sitting there sweating it out. And Otto is cutting my hair. And I don't know what this, you know, as a kid, 9-year-old kid, talk to the barber. The barber doesn't talk to the kid now. Usually they do. And I'm just getting cut, and it went all the way down. And he cut and cut and cut and cut and cut and cut. And finally, the man back of the cash register came over, and he says, "Let me look at it." He says, "Okay, it's okay." And Otto didn't say anything. He put his scissors down and his brush down. And I got down off the chair, and I start to walk out. And the man at the cash register says, "Tell your mother that if she's still unhappy, I'll do it myself. Okay?" And I turned around, and I says, "Yeah, okay." And Otto says, "Goodbye, little boy." And I went out, and I walked all the way home, and I felt awful. Oh, boy, I don't know. It was a moment of revelation. But, I wasn't worried about Otto at all. It wasn't 100 years later I realized what had happened. I was worried about me. Don't worry about it, will you? I was worried about me. All the way back home I go, sweating it out. And I get home, and my mother looked at me, and she says, "You look terrible. You look terrible." And, boy, moment of revelation. And, the haircut trauma is a trauma, I'm sure, that no girl has ever had. And they don't really have that trauma. I'm sure they don't. They have hairdo traumas, but that's another thing entirely. That's little ipsy-poo stuff. But when you're, oh, yes, it is, oh, yes. But when you're sitting there and you're a man and you're sitting in the barber chair, do you know that there's a barber shop down on 28th Street called the No Embarrassment Barber Shop? So, speaking of embarrassments, this is WORAM and you got the thing in there, ET? No? You don't have it. How come? Well, then don't play that. No, that should be up. This is WORAM at FM New York, and we'll be here. Speaking of the trauma, a couple of weeks ago, I went into a barbershop. This is the kind of thing that you don't know how to handle, and yet you do. You kind of handle it instinctively. I'm sitting in the barber chair, and all around you can hear the counterpoint. There is a certain kind of man, a certain sort of man, whose only pleasure in life is derived from being over other people. And it's an interesting thing. This is, in a way, tied up with one aspect of what we generally call, I hate to say this, there's two ways to look at it. About 10 ways, but I'm gonna sketch something for you, and you draw your own conclusions. There is a man in this town who is a very famous man, and he's a television type, very famous on television, and he's become internationally known, and he's a beautiful glib talker. He has a fairly good education, a good one actually. Hey, he's almost the epitome of the sharp, beautifully tailored, successful, liberal thinker. That kind of person who asks the right things, is concerned over the right things, who is always speaking about, angrily about segregation, asking pointed questions and making all sorts of searching, searching insights into the whole problem of man getting along with man and man loving man. Fascinating man. And he's gained a kind of national reputation for this sort of thing. A very liberal person who loves his fellow man, but loves him with an enlightened intelligence of the man who follows the logical chain of thought sequences of the well-educated mind. It's all there. It's all right. Well, one day I'm having lunch with him. And this was right at the very peak of his gaining his big thing, you know, gaining his national reputation in this kind of right-thinking field. You know what I mean by the right-thinking field? It's kind of the Upper East Side liberals, you know? And by the way, I am not a conservative. So don't say, you know, it's interesting, whenever you use a word, whenever you talk about one side or the other, they assume that you're one or the other side. No. I happen to be a liberal. But this is another kind. It's a very special kind. And so one day we're having lunch. And where do we go? We go to Lindy's, of all places. I'd only been in Lindy's maybe two or three times up to that period in my life. And we went to Lindy's during the non-tourist hour, when Lindy's becomes a restaurant instead of a kind of a shrine of some kind. And we're just there, and it's about 8 or 9 o'clock, something like that, on a weekend night. Nobody around, very quiet. We sit down, and my liberal friend calls the waiter over, and the little waiter comes over. And you know, there's two sets of waiters in most of these places. There are the showbiz waiters who work the big rush hours, and then there's the little guys that stand in the back who take all the crud, that take all the little, you know, the little orders that come in, like at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and order a ham sandwich and go. That's another set of waiters. And we got one of those waiters. A little shuffling man came out, and he walked over to us and says, what can I do for you? And he says, I'd like to see the menu. Okay? And it's a certain breeziness. You know, there is an attitude that people develop that they're totally in charge of the human race. They are in control. It's the hip people that put on TV shows, you know, that control audiences. You know that sort of thing? Who look upon the world as a mass, and they work in the mass, you know. They know how to do these. This is a great doers. There's another thing, too, about that. There are certain people who are great doers, who get the enormous show put on. They get Mary Martin, and they get all the things going, you know. They pull all the wires, and all the whistles blow, and the bells ring, and somehow you get the impression that these are geniuses, that they are men beyond the ken of men, you know. They're a special breed of men. Well, they are, really, in a sense. These are men who have, in a way, who have never really looked at themselves and who spend most of their time looking at mankind and the world, and they know how to work the whole machine, you know, the whole business, the whole pizzazz. I one time stood in the elevator with a man who owns half of the West Side. In fact, he owns three quarters of the East Side. He's the only man I've ever known who could pick up a telephone at 8 o'clock in the morning, make one single call, and say, I'd like... Let's see, from 47th Street down to 14th Street, from 8th Avenue over to Broadway, I'd like that leveled by tomorrow morning. I want a parking lot there. And it would happen, just like that. Well, I'm in the elevator with him, and I turned to him and I said, how does it feel to be able to pick up the phone tomorrow morning and have half a Times Square made into a circus by tomorrow morning? He looked at me. So what do you mean? You putting me on? I said, no, I just want to know how it feels, you know? There are people who have power and there are people who don't. Really, that's the way it is. And he said, never thought of it that way. I said, well, think about it, will you? And you know, about every 6 months now, I get a letter from him. He's still thinking about it. And I think it's lowered his batting average because it's worried him now. He's beginning to be conscious of his stance. Well, anyway, I'm standing, sitting there with this guy in Lindy's, and the little waiter comes over and he says, "What do you have?" And he takes a look at the menu and he says, "I will have lean roast beef on rye with horseradish, just a little on the side. Lean roast beef on rye." And the man says, "Yes, sir." He says, "What'll you have?" I said, "Oh, I don't care. Scrambled eggs, toast, something. Just bring it. Scrambled eggs and toast. Okay. So we went back to talking. And the man is talking to me with the pure light. And by the way, we are talking about something so idealistic that it would make your hair curl if I described it to you. Oh, you know, about people who've got to get together. Now, my function in life, I've got to communicate these things that people must understand: love, intelligence, education, etc., etc., ad infinitum, segregation, desegregation, in hoc agricula, all in all, while it's going, you see. Well, the little waiter comes over, puts down the sandwich in front of him, lays my eggs down. Instantly, he turns and he says, "What did you bring me this for?" I said, "Lean beef." "Now take that back. I want lean beef, you fool." The little waiter picks it up. "Yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir." And he goes back to the kitchen. And about 3 minutes later, he comes back out and he lays another sandwich down there. My friend didn't even miss a beat. He says, "Look, how many times am I going to have to send this sandwich back? Why don't you listen to me, you fool? I said lean beef. Now, either you bring me lean beef or I'm going to have to call for the manager. Now go ahead and get lean beef." And a little guy shaking like that all the way. You can see the booths all the way up and down the line. You know, people are looking out to see what's going on out there. And my friend, without even so much as missing a beat, goes right back into love, right back into democracy, belief in the eternal dignity of man. By the way, it's one of his favorite phrases, the dignity of man. And he goes on and on and on. And a little man comes back again, and he's got the sandwich. He lays it down, and you can see the sandwich has been it's been clipped with scissors or something all the way around. You know, the beef is all laying there. There's nothing on it. And my friend doesn't even miss a beat. He says, "Take it back. I don't want anything." You don't even know how to listen. I finished my eggs, and we left. We walked along Broadway in the sunshine, and we talked about humanity and mankind. Birds and flowers. Guess who it is? Hold it there. Put that. Come on. Yeah. No, the other one. No. You know. Yeah, that's right. All together now.
Oh, my. So a million men might follow. One man opened the way. William Holden, Lily Palmer, in the Pearl Berg Seton production, The Counterfeit Traitor. You have never seen more magnificent adventure. Here are the astonishing days and nights of an extraordinary man who lived and loved and fought with more passionate intensity than 1,000 men. But this is more than the story of one man, one woman, one magnificent adventure. It is the story of all the people, little as well as great, whose lives were the glory of an explosive era. William Holden, Lily Palmer, The Counterfeit Traitor.
See The Counterfeit Traitor, now playing at the DeMille Theater, 7th Avenue and 47th Street. Whew. You know, it takes a while for you to begin to see that almost everything in your life, almost every person you meet, almost every statement that is made, almost every action that is taken, is pretty nearly diametrically opposed to what is actually behind it, what is actually there. In fact, you know, we believe so much. I'll never forget the time I worked. I guess most people never have the good fortune, in a way. In some ways, it's not good fortune, because it must be wonderful to walk through the world believing that you have the answers. It must be great to walk through the world believing that you can solve things by a simple action. Like the other day, I was listening to a man give a speech, a very interesting speech, and he was a far, 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 way out political type thinker, and this was typical of his statements. I believe that what we should stand for is we should stand for a stronger America. I believe we should stand for a stronger concept of democracy, and I believe that we should take this message of democracy and show the peoples of the world what it really means.
I feel, for one thing, that we should now go down into Cuba and by force of arms, if need be.
Oh, boy. You know, I'm sitting there sweating because it's so easy. All these things come rolling out. And this is a very simple problem, and yet it's almost a impossibly complicated problem. The simple answer, the miracle. All the way through our advertising, you can see the word miracle appearing. The new miracle wash day device. The new way to lose weight and eat more. This is another one of those wonderful miracles. Almost every month, there are probably anywhere from 5 to 15 diets in magazines telling you that now, at long last, the diet has been discovered that will enable you to lose 7 pounds in 7 days and eat just as much as you've always eaten without so much as one extra moment of exercise in your life. Yes, follow these simple rules. Oh, yes, they promise everything. The far side there. I think this, in the mail I received this today. It's a beautiful example. TNT, the power within you, shows you how to release and use God-given powers like these. How to increase your brain power. How to get true hunches and train yourself to rely upon them. How to free yourself from unknown tension and fears, how to build up a storehouse of renewed energy and strength, how to see through problems easily, make the right decisions quickly, how you can actually shape your own destiny simply. Oh, listen to that one. How you can shape your own destiny simply. Oh, great Scott. How to turn your pipe dreams into wonderful reality. How to make your life what you want it to be. How to keep yourself forever from growing old. Yes, TNT is that something within which you have, when released and set in motion by faith, can work miracles. Phenomenal results have been obtained by thousands of persons who have understood and applied the principles and mechanics outlined in this great book. All used the hidden power within them to get what they wanted. You can do the same. And the beauty of all this is, listen carefully, it's a power you have always had within your understanding and within your grasp. It requires no training, no effort whatsoever. Yes, friends, once you learn the astounding secrets of the power within you, and you will, in just one reading, you can overcome any obstacle, meet any circumstance, defeat any condition, face the things you've been running away from for years, at no effort whatsoever. Yes, you'll discover that changing rotten feeling into youthful energy and enthusiasm is the easiest thing you'll ever do, anytime, anywhere. Oh, what are we dreaming about? This could just as well be a political tract, you know. Have you ever attended one of these big pep rallies? Prep, that's a very interesting juxtaposition of words, because it's usually the clean-limbed and the bright-faced who believe in great slogans. It's funny, you know? I don't know what it is. What perverse thing within human nature that makes the more educated become more hung up on slogans? They really do. A strange way. They really do. The more educated a man, the more he believes that a big slogan called Ban the Bomb will do it. Somehow that'll straighten out things in human nature, you know. Hold up a big sign, love. It's hardly ever the uneducated man on the street that's holding up those signs. Fascinating. I don't know what it is. And yet at the same time, there is a thing within each one of us that makes us feel as though something has not opened up. Something has not allowed us to do whatever it is that we think we could do if the gates were open. You know what I'm talking about here? What is this thing that we think we can do? Is it my friend eating a sandwich that he will never take at Lindy's? I don't know. I wonder about what people think of in terms of making the success, the thing up at the top. I remember, you know, it's funny. I remember one time, old man Bruner, living next door to us. Old man Bruner used to come home about every third or fourth night with a snootful. And you could hear him out there kicking over the clothes poles, getting caught in the clotheslines out in the backyard, finally reeling his way up the back porch and slamming open the screen door. He lived in the kind of house that year in and year out, season in and season out, they had a screen door always on. They never took the screens down until finally the screens just melted and all you had up there was just the frames, little pieces of rusty screen. And old man Bruner had come reeling in and reeling out, and then the word got out that Bruner had gotten himself a job, a real job. There was a funny feeling in the neighborhood. Bruner's going to make it. Bruner is going to make it. And Bruner began to shave and began to dress up. And every couple of days you'd see Bruner at night going out with a white shirt and a blue suit. And he'd have his wife, Mrs. Bruner. By the way, Mrs. Bruner was almost the prototype of the true story reader. Today she would be reading Debbie and Eddie, and the life of Elizabeth Taylor and Dick Burton. She was involved in all that stuff. And you could see Mrs. Bruner sitting there next to the, I remember 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, you'd see Mrs. Bruner sitting in her dining room window, right across the driveway from us, reading True Story, with her hair up in rheostats. Sitting there, reading this stuff, going along through it all. And she always said, you know, I remember Mrs. Bruner came from Kentucky, and this is the way she talked. She'd say, you know, they couldn't print this stuff unless it was true, Miss Shepherd. These are true stories. I don't like to read stuff that's not true. And I enjoy reading True Story because it's all true. Now, there was about this 15-year-old girl, and the title of the story, it's a very interesting story. You ought to read it. It's a wonderful story. The title of the story is, It Happened After the Prom, and I Have Been Sorry Ever Since. It's this wonderful little 15-year-old girl. Now, this is the kind of stuff, I think this is uplifting stuff. And, Mr. Bruner, of course, going back and forth to work night after night, day after day. He was her true story. And her true story was not as true as the 15-year-old girl in the magazine, obviously. And so all the while, Mrs. Bruner is knitting, my mother is going along, my father is going one way, and then one day. You want to know what happened to Mr. Bruner? I better not tell you what happened to Mr. Bruner in the end. I better not. I remember one thing about Mr. Bruner, though, that I can tell. I can remember Mr. Bruner's father, who was always reported to be shell-shocked from the war. He was always called shell-shocked. Well, he wasn't shell-shocked at all, now that I think about it. Old man Bruner, his father, the old man Bruner, was actually a very early beat. A very early beat. And he just sort of lived on the front porch, is all he ever did. Once in a while, he'd come out and he'd play catch and stuff. And then he would walk over to the railing of the porch and spit. He was a tobacco man, chewing tobacco, down there among the lilac hedges. And he always said, by the way, that it made lilac hedges grow better. I am not a botanist. I am not prepared to, except they had 30-foot lilac hedges. I do know this. And, it's wild. Old man Bruner going, you'd hear him there deep among those humming bees and among those turnips. And that would be about all you ever heard from him. Until one day the word got out that Mr. Bruner, the old man, had left home. I used to ask Junior, what happened to Grandpa? Said, I don't know, he just left. He just left. And it left a hole in everybody's life. Even though old man Bruner, the old grandpa, never said anything to anybody. He left a hole, a distinct hole. Mrs. Bruner sat by the window just as she always had. Mr. Bruner went back and forth just as he always had. And the old lilac bushes continued to grow. We played catch out in the yard, but everyone knew it had happened. Something was gone. And a very interesting thing happened. Old man Bruner quit his job about 2 weeks after his father left. The old man left, old man Bruner quit his job. That isn't the kind of work a man should do. I don't know what his work was, but that was the word. Just not the kind of work a man should do. And so we went back on relief. Tried to grab those old glories again. Tried to grab those old Saturday nights and the one day a month at the roundhouse. He was on the extra board, you know, for over 30 years. You know what the extra board is in the railroad? Yes, grasp that power within you, that TNT that lies just below the surface. Make yourself real, big, honest. Overcome all obstacles. Stride forward. All together, man. And then there are those of us who take refuge in the system, who bury us in details, who begin to slowly work our way into the woodwork. You know, this town is filled with people who are hung up on schedules, who are hung up on watching the vacation list go up, who are hung up on watching the changes in the file department and keeping the collection of memos all in chronological order. You take refuge in that, you know, an odd way. I've heard it said that Sir Barnabas Beer spent most of his long and distinguished career in moving great masses of paper about, from a tray marked in to another marked out. There you are. Speaking of raising yourself up out of that vast morass, that mire, we have with us tonight the Mandarin House. And let me say this. Look, I'm not going to burden you with anything. All I have to say is that go there. Just go to the Mandarin House once and go any evening of the week and order anything. But I'll tell you one thing I would like to recommend beyond all the things they have there at Mandarin House. Just a thing. What do they call them? No, those little spare ribs, those tiny ones that are about the size of, oh, like a half inch. Sweet, but they weren't sweet sour, really, were they? Oh, that's not Mandarin. No, there was a name. Little spare ribs that are done in a kind of soy sauce that has a sweet and a sour and a kind of I can't read that. Pungent? No. People immediately think of sweet and sour jazz, you know, with the syrup on it. No. Go. I'll tell you what you do. Listen to me carefully. When you go to the Mandarin House, tell them you want the little spare ribs that have the soy sauce on them, the pungent, sweet soy sauce. They'll know what. And tell them I said so, because then they'll know what kinds, because they have about 19,000 ways to fix spare ribs down there. These are fantastic, really. I have eaten in Chinese restaurants since I was 3 feet high, and this is the end. And if you'd like to try the Mandarin House, they're on 13th Street, between 6th and 7th, here in Manhattan, right down the village. Just go straight down 6th Avenue. Take the 6th Avenue subway. Get off at 14th Street, as a matter of fact. Walk down one block to 13th. They're between 6th and 7th on 13th. They're open every night until midnight. And they're open on Sundays till 1 in the morning. They're open 7 days a week. I don't think they have any more places in the school, do they? The school is all filled up? Too bad. Now, you know, it's a funny thing. I got this thing in the mail. And as you probably know, whenever I do a show, I don't know whether you know it or not, but I might as well tell you a little bit of the mechanics of how it works. Maybe you shouldn't, you know? It's funny. Most writers will tell you, never tell people how you write. Never tell them how you conceive and construct the form that you work in. Well, I say this, that when I receive something, or when I contact something, when I see something around me, when I feel something, I am more of a reactor than anything else, I suppose. A kind of imperfect lens, a sort of unsilvered mirror. And I react to things that happen, and the show then is based on the reaction of a thing. And somehow I was profoundly depressed to be flashed before and to see on the screen again of the mind the eternal dream that everyone has, that any minute now, by some miracle, some wonderful miracle at no exertion to yourself at all, it's going to be cured. It's all going to be okay. It's going to be all right. But see, the sad part of it is that hardly anyone seems to realize that it is all right, you know. It really is. That Mrs. Bruner could not have been happier than to have old man Bruner going out maybe every third or fourth night. That was the way it was. That was the way it always will be. It's like this native I met in Enugu who could not comprehend being not a fisherman living in Lagos. That was the way it was. And that's the way it is. I mean, there are balloons. Some go up, some come down. But that's the way it is. You know? You know what I mean, baby?
This is WOR Radio, your station for news.